Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. Today, we're going to be talking with Evlando Cooper. He's a senior writer writing about climate and energy programs for Media Matters for America. He's intent on identifying false, misleading media narratives related to climate change and energy issues. He also, fortunately, keeps his eye out for positive news, too. It's important to keep our mind open to the idea that the media is not necessarily always negative on climate. I think one of the issues, and Evlando is going to highlight this, is that the media, while maybe neutral, often doesn't speak out when it should. And of course, Evlando and Media Matters take a look at sources where we might think there would be negative news coming out, but they also keep track of mainstream media, which frankly is not doing that great a job on climate change and related issues. That's why it's fortunate that we have people like Evlando and Media Matters to track what's going on there. So as we are concerned about the news or non-news about climate change that's broadcast by the media, we've got somebody to give us the data about what's actually going on. Evlando just recently published via Media Matters an extensive and well-researched paper, How Broadcast TV Networks Covered Climate Change in 2020. A bit about Media Matters. It's a web-based, not-for-profit research information center, and that's what they do. They monitor, analyze, and correct misinformation in the U.S. media. And in particular, today we're talking about that misinformation regarding climate change. I'm especially happy to have Evlando with us just because he's a Tacoma resident. He's got his finger on the pulse of things climate-wise, climate justice-wise right here in Tacoma, too.
So I'm delighted to have Evlando Cooper with us today. He's a senior writer and researcher for
Media Matters. And Evlando, welcome. Glad to have you.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me today.
Hey, it's good to be talking. So why don't you start off by just giving us a bit of a background on what your areas of interest are around climate change, climate justice. And as always, we like to keep it tied into Tacoma South Sound to the extent that we can.
Yeah. So before I moved to Tacoma 2, maybe 3 years ago now, I began working for Media Matters, and I'm still there. And I serve as a senior writer researcher for the Climate and Energy Program, mostly monitoring media disinformation narratives around climate change, environmental justice, the environment generally. So that's the kind of broad outline of my work.
So a little bit about Evlando. How did you get into this area of interest?
So I'll make a long story short.
Okay.
But I was living in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005. Oh. And to me, I had always had an interest in generally in climate change. But my most formative experience was going through Katrina and then learning about how it was, how climate change played a role in the storm's destructiveness. And then from there, learning about the fossil fuel industry's billion-dollar campaign to undermine the public and political consensus on climate science and the need for climate action. So that's what my interest in climate change began. And a few years ago, when I was living in Washington, D.C., I worked for a nonprofit kind of investigative watchdog that looked at regulatory capture and climate disinformation. And then from there, began working for Media Matters, specifically hired to monitor these narratives. So it was a very happy, lucky happenstance of kind of marrying my growing interest in this subject matter with work along those lines.
Yeah, there's nothing like having a job or a career that aligns with one's passion. So I'm happy for you for that. So,
yes,
and just a bit about Media Matters too. So sketch out for us a 30,000 foot view. What's Media Matters all about?
Media Matters is a progressive nonprofit organization dedicated to monitoring right-wing disinformation across a variety of issue areas. This includes climate, includes guns, it includes LGBTQ issues, I mean, you name it, you know, my colleagues and coworkers, you know, I think they're heroes for how they kind of wade into this, you know, fever swamp of misinformation, disinformation, monitor it, bring it to attention, like Fox News, even social media, to kind of like highlight these narratives. And more importantly, highlight how these narratives actually make it into the mainstream news, how, you know, the right wing, these narratives trickle up from the right wing and they make it into mainstream news and then they become kind of standard talking points. We see this in the climate space all the time, but it happens across issue areas. So we kind of monitor it, call it out, and then try to affect change when we can.
Yeah, so you use the word courage in there and talking about that. So do you get pushback from the right wing, let's say, on some of the work that you do? I'm talking about kind of more personal pushback rather than just maybe arguing in the media.
I don't experience it as much. I think, you know, a lot of my work in particular, you know, we call it out. We try to bring attention to it. We push for changes. A lot of what I do also is focusing on trying to prevent mainstream media sources, cable news, broadcast news, from picking up on these narratives. We also try to push them to cover climate change and environmental justice more. So I don't experience as much as the kind of right wing, the nasty right wing pushback as some of my colleagues do, because I'm not involved in some of the more heated discourses of the day. So I'm lucky that way, that I don't have to deal with it as directly as some of my other coworkers do.
Okay, gotcha. So in your specific area, not so much, but some other areas, some folks are having to deal with that kind of dynamic, which is a shame, of course. It's counterproductive to this idea of free discourse and open dialogue and looking for common ground and compromise. Remember when we used to do that stuff? So
yeah, I mean, there used to be much more good faith efforts, you know, but we see a lot less of that in our kind of stratified social media environment in particular. Yeah,
it's a worrisome thing for sure, and it's showing up everywhere. So in the work that you do around climate change and climate justice, what's on your plate right now, or what do you see that are kind of the upfront issues that you're dealing with right now?
So my program just produced our annual climate broadcast study, which looks at how broadcast TV news cover climate change. That came out about a little more than a month ago. We found that climate coverage as a whole made up only 0.4% of overall coverage on broadcast morning, nightly, and Sunday morning news shows in 2020. So that's, we just completed that work, and that number is stunning. And we've been getting a lot of pickup and calls for people demanding that they do a much better job covering the climate crisis. Most recently, we published a study about how broadcast TV news covers issues around environmental justice. And long story short, we found that corporate broadcast news rarely fails to consistently contextualize how environmental impacts, regulations and health hazards disproportionately harm marginalized communities. You know, a lot of the stories that were tangentially related to environmental justice that might have mentioned a specific demographic group, often very shallow, and it never explore how America's history of racial and economic exploitation has led to worse health outcomes for vulnerable communities.
Yes. Yeah, so you use the term broadcast, just so I'm clear. Is cable news included in that heading of broadcast?
Not for broadcast. We do studies about cable news coverage, but broadcast specifically refers to the big three: ABC, CBS, NBC.
Gotcha. Okay. Thanks for that clarity. So, just off the top of my head, I would find it difficult to categorize those big networks as either left of center or right of center. Okay. So basically what it is just kind of a corporate, let's say somewhat apolitical ignoring of climate change and climate justice. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I don't, you know, the agenda is silence. You know, I mean, they've been trying to do a better job in some ways, but I mean, you know, yeah, a lot of it reads largely as ignoring the issue or failing to connect the science. You know, a lot of what we see is like for extreme weather, for instance, you know, they don't make the basic connection between what scientists have found that climate change this is exacerbating hurricanes, for instance, or wildfires, you know, and like, you know, even making that basic connection between the climate science and the actual impact that we're witnessing. They don't do that on a consistent or substantive basis. When it came to environment, the environmental justice, they would report on an explosion or a spill or something like that. But they never said they never talked about how these companies specifically seek to avoid accountability, how they work to have lax standards, how they site their infrastructure next to vulnerable communities who don't have the power to push back. So, you know, a lot of that, when people see this on the news, they say, oh, it's just an isolated incident. And they don't actually see how these things are connected. And if you don't see how it's connected, then you don't see how there are public policy solutions to actually address this and do something about it.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit of a disadvantage here because I absolutely don't watch broadcast news. I mean, I tried, but it seems, I don't know, very shallow. It seems more entertainment oriented than, you know, it's like capturing people's imagination, making sure they don't change the channel and stuff like that. So yes. I get my news from print media. I mean, I get it electronically, but print media. I read 3 or 4 newspapers a day, and I watch some cable news. And full disclosure, I discipline myself to watch Hannity about 10 minutes a night. I mean, I do find personal value in that, just in the sense that I need to know what's going on outside my bubble of people who tend to view the world the same way I do. And it's very uncomfortable. But so in terms of climate change, or climate justice, I'm thinking about Katrina. You mentioned Katrina, and I'm looking back at what I think of as the media coverage back then. And of course, it was an incredible disaster. I mean, just a horrible, horrible thing. And of course, people of color were the ones that were most severely impacted. And my sense looking back is that the coverage was sort of like, well, this is these people's fault. You know, that why did they stay there? I mean, is that a fair recollection of what the coverage was like?
Yeah, I mean, it was the pathologizing of poor people, of poor Black people. You know, in New Orleans, the kind of city's natural vulnerability to storms, like, you know, to hurricanes being below sea level, was exacerbated by this, by, you know, decades of government neglect and indifference. 35% of the Black population at the time lived beneath the poverty line. And 54% of poor folks in New Orleans didn't even have a vehicle to evacuate.
Yeah.
So, you know, failing to contextualize these people's lives before the storm hit leads to coverage that blames people's outcomes on their own bad or immoral behavior. Yeah. And I think that's just super harmful to finding any kind of public policy solution to actually improve people's lives.
Yeah, it seems like there's a theme in our culture that we're much happier pointing our fingers at other folks than to look at problems and seek solutions to those problems.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. So having made, you know, that comment, generally in terms of climate justice, and we can tie it into the media if that's appropriate.
Sure.
What do people who are concerned, engaged, what do we do about that?
Well, okay. So I love this topic. But before I jump right into what individuals can do, I just want to, and I'm sure you and your listeners know, but I always feel the need to say it, is that the fossil fuel industry is the single greatest emitter of carbon. and it is heavily invested in individuating the solutions to this crisis. They spend millions of dollars on greenwashing campaigns to launder their reputations and to avoid accountability for the decades of harm that they've done. So first and foremost, I think that they must be held liable for climate change, for global warming, and they must be and that accountability must include a shift from a fossil fuel economy to a much greener one. Now, as citizens, I think first we need to wake up to the forces allied against us. Like I said, these are entire industries and corporations dedicated to plundering the planet for profit. They exert a great deal of influence through government, front groups, and the media to try to obfuscate this fact. I think also we must decouple corporate solutions that focus on maintaining consumptive lifestyles. We need to find a way to get back in balance with nature. We have to become more engaged, more skeptical, more self-determinative. And I think there are great examples of this throughout our community on issues ranging from the tide flats to housing justice. But I think the ranks must swell very quickly because the people that are profiting from our planet's demise won't go quietly. So those are just some of the high level things that I think we can
use. Yeah, so one of the things I say frequently is, I mean, a lot of folks they're concerned, but they're not raising their voices. You know, what difference do I make? Drop in the bucket, all of that. And one of the points I make is, you know, the voice that isn't raised is the least effective voice. I mean, I can't be guaranteed that I'm going to have any effect on anything. But if I sit quietly in my house and swear at the TV set, nothing's going to get better. So I think what I hear. No, go ahead, please.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to that point. That's why, you know, as part of the media critique, I mean, there are studies that show that, you know, the media can play a role in decreasing public apathy and increasing public engagement around climate change. You know, that's why I think we go so hard at having them, you know, not only discuss climate change consequences, but also discuss potential solutions as well. So, because, yeah, some folks, you know, if you click on the news, if you click on cable, either you're not hearing about it or you think the problem's intractable, there's nothing you can do. So I do agree that people must, people have to become more engaged, more active. But I think the media also has to present an honest vision of the challenges that we confront and ways to address it.
Yeah, well, I'm totally on tune with you. I mean, typically what I say is, you know, about one third of what we can do to address these issues is within the grasp of individuals, but two thirds of it is systemic and outside of our hands. And when I asked you the question originally, I didn't make this explicit, but it was more like, okay, how do we as individuals impact that two thirds that is so responsible for what's going on? Because turning down the thermostat or whatever is I'm not encouraging people to waste energy, but we can't fix it. And you use the term individuation, which I hadn't heard in this respect before. And I think it's an really important point, and that is that industry, and I'm thinking fossil fuels, I'm also thinking of the plastics industry, which is related. They're very good at getting folks to think, oh, wow, this is my fault. And that the corporation gets off the hook because it's like when I see stuff, bring stuff into my house and the packaging says, please recycle on it. It's like, okay, the corporation is, okay, we're good. We said, please recycle. Now it's out of our hands. So, yeah. No, please go ahead. There's a little lag here. It's just
please continue your question. Please ask your question. I think I want to answer it anyway.
Okay, so let me ask you a question about Evlando in particular, because this is one that comes up for me all the time. I mean, this radio program is one thing I do, but I'm a climate activist, and I spend a lot of time wondering about how to message what it is I'm concerned about. So if somebody were to ask you, are you optimistic about our future or are you pessimistic? How do you maintain your energy, your commitment, like we used to say back in the 60s, keep on keeping on. How do you do that? And where do you come down on that, all of that?
So I think I'll answer in two parts, because I think the part that keeps me optimistic is, one, recognizing, again, like I mentioned earlier, that I'm just lucky and blessed to be able to work on an issue of importance to me and feel like I'm making a difference a small way in that. I also become very involved in the local community through Tacoma DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, through working on a Sustainable Tacoma Commission, through my work with groups like Climate Paris County, of trying to at least, you know, turn my cynicism into optimism by doing what I feel that I can to try to make a difference. I think, like, big picture, what gives me a little optimism is that, you know, it is one or two or three primary industries driving this, right? And the kind of, you know, mass people power is the way that we will be able to confront that. I think what we have to do is recognize that the thing that drives humanity largely, this idea of betterment and improvement, it may not look like, you know, a kind of Jetsons future of flying cars and gleaming smart cities. I think we have to reorient our understanding of what a good life is, how to live contented, healthy lives that are more in balance with nature. I think once we have that kind of larger understanding, it'll give us the strength to kind of fight for a future that may not look like the one we envision, but is one that, you know, allows us to lead more dignified lives. What discourages me and kind of keeps me up is also, like, as human beings, we're kind of using a lot of the same operative software frameworks that our ancestors did. And so, you know, this kind of inability to plan for a long-term future, at least on an aggregate level, you know, the science is incontrovertible. If we don't rapidly decarbonize, we risk a future of precarity and turmoil for our entire species. You know, that's why climate denial is so dangerous. It gives us this kind of false idea that maybe we can just wait around and see how things shake out. Maybe it won't be as bad as they say it will be. But I think we're squandering the one advantage that our ancestors never had when faced with plagues or famine or rapid climate shifts. We have the science that tells us exactly what's going to happen if we continue on our current course. And we're just getting a glimpse of it now, between the heat, sea level rise, wildfires, storms. So I think the problem of trying to fit our current civilization into what will necessarily have to be a new paradigm, we have to get past that. Hope is good. It's a quintessential human trait. But at some point in the near future, that hope has to motivate us to kind of meaningful action. So I hope I didn't go on too long. But
no, that was awesome. Implied in a lot of what you said there was, I believe, that we, as a species, we really are going through a major transition here. I mean, we're facing a lot of stuff that, as a species, we've never had to face, at least on this scale, before.
Yes.
And as you suggested there too, I think that a lot of the ways of seeing the world that have worked for us in the past are not working for us now. And so in my mind, the big question is how are we going to make that shift? One of the things that, and we can talk about that here in a bit. One of the things that you related to there was, the idea of, contentment in life. And I see more and more that we're so, especially in our culture, we're so married to the idea, if I just had more stuff, I'd be happier. And I was looking at a graph of the gross domestic product the other day, and constant dollars per capita. And all I got to do is look at that graph and say, we can't do this forever. You know, we buy stuff, we use it, it lands up in the landfill, we buy some more stuff. And so I guess it seems almost intractable that our species is going to be able to make this kind of transition. So cheer me up on that.
Yeah. Like I mentioned, you know, green capital isn't going to save us. Like no economic system built on exploitation and commodification of air, land, water, much less our fellow human beings, is going to get us out of this. the incentives to tackle climate change, to mitigate its worst consequences, cannot be market-based. I think we're getting to a tipping point where, you know, people are kind of waking up. I mean, you can look at like Yale Climate Group, their studies. The more people have to deal with the consequences of extreme weather in their own personal lives, whether or not they accept the science of climate change, they want something done. They want the government to do something to stop it, to address it. So, you know, I just hope that the tipping point doesn't come past the tipping point for climate change, right? So, the part that gives me hope is like the more attention is drawn to this, I got to give a shout out to the youth climate movement in this area and across the country, across the world, really. You know, they've brought more attention to this issue. I mean, there have been a lot of environmental justice activists, climate activists fighting for decades, but the energy coming out of the youth movement and their kind of willingness to consider different ways of living, different ways the future may look, that gives me hope. So I just hope that these things don't coalesce past the point where, you know, the worst consequences of climate change are baked in.
Yeah, I think that it's necessary for us to maintain a degree of optimism. I spent 5 years in the Marine Corps, and I did several survival schools, and we got a lot of training about survival. And one of the very clear facts was that you could take an individual or a group that were in a survival situation that were pretty much identical. And if one group was pessimistic, you know, that like, well, we're not going to succeed here, they didn't do as well as groups in the same situation that said, you know, we think we can get through this. We're optimistic. So I think that I want to be realistic. I don't want to be a Pollyanna, but I do want to carry that edge of optimism.
It's a fine line between, and I see this debate play out all the time among climate communicators, climate scientists, about, you know, it's a razor's edge between doom and gloom and what spurs people to action if you're too doom and gloom, you know, and I can't settle that debate, but I do think carrying a balance of optimism is the only thing that's going to carry a message that'll get people to actually be invested in this future.
Yeah. And okay. In terms of where we go with an economic system, which is such a huge subject that it's really beyond my grasp and my area of expertise, but it does seem that I look at the process of extraction, manufacturing, consumption, pollution, that's just not tenable. So in your own mind, when you look into the future, how would you see our economic system evolving?
Like I mentioned, you know, a little bit ago, it can't be this idea of squeezing our consumptive lifestyle, but just making it green. I think we have to reassess kind of the modern way that we live, our ideas of progress. I think if we want to continue down this course of, like you say, consumptive economy, consumptive lifestyle, we're baking in the same kind of exploitation, greed, dehumanization in a green capitalist system as we would have in the fossil fuel economy. I think we have to just start in getting back to the idea of human dignity, the dignity of work, of creating a society that values everybody. And necessarily from there, you know, a lot of what environmental justice is exploiting the vulnerabilities of a population for profit, a population that can't fight back. It's the whole NIMBY problem, right? Like, why are some things built in some places and not in others? Because the people with power and money have a say-so in what happens in their neighborhood. So I think we get to a society and a system that just values the dignity of human life, of human work, we can begin correcting some of the larger challenges of creating an economy that's not built on consumption and exploitation, whether it's green or fossil fuel.
That's really well put. Some lights are going off for me on this because it makes real clear the nexus between addressing climate change and climate justice. So you use the term green capitalism. We're going to be facing, as you say, we're going to be facing a lot of the same problems there if we don't figure out a way of having a just society at the same time.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so
because, you know, we talk about resource extraction. I don't want to glom on the same problems that we have now onto a system that's green, because the people being exploited are going to be the same people that were exploited before. You know, we have to really think about what that looks like.
Yeah. So really well put. So we've got a few more minutes here. I just wanted to ask you briefly, I noticed in going over some of the research and writing that you've been doing, some work done on the Sinclair Broadcast Group concerning from reading your writing. So could you sketch out what's going on there with the Sinclair Broadcast Group, especially when it comes, if possible, you can relate it to climate change kind of issues?
Sure thing. And I just want to give a shout out to my coworker, Pam Vogel, who's done more work than anybody on kind of detailing what Sinclair is and how they operate. But kind of high level, they're basically a conservative media conglomerate that has quietly, or less quietly, not at, since Pam's been on the case, been buying up a lot of local TV stations. And as part of their deal, they were including these must-run segments, which are kind of nationally directed news segments that had a very rightward, a conservative slant that had to air on these local stations. And I think the problem with that, most obviously, is that people trust their local newscasters, right? So, you know, they were being forced to say, run these segments that they may necessarily not have agreed with or even wanted to run, and giving it the kind of imprimatur of the local newscast. The latest thing that I did that I helped work on was around the pro-fossil fuel propaganda they were pushing around the time of the, you know, early in the year. They were talking about this false idea of U.S. energy independence. They were talking about Biden's moratorium on oil and gas leases, why that would be bad for the country, for the economy. You know, they have their fingers in a lot of different areas. But yeah, they're definitely one of the key propagators of this kind of fossil fuel mythology around energy independence, around the idea that any kind of reining into the fossil fuel industry would be bad for national security. They're very slick with how these things are packaged and presented. So people should definitely keep an eye on Sinclair. They should definitely be critical if they see things that may not align with how the broadcast normally is, because a lot of times these folks don't have a choice about what to run.
Pretty ugly. So are there any Sinclair stations in Washington that you know of?
Yeah, that's a good question. I should have prepared to answer that.
Yeah, no worries. I tell you what I'm going to do when I do the outro. Maybe you can send me a note on what the background on that is, and then I'll just include it in my outro comments. No worries about that.
Yeah, so, we definitely have a way to look it up, so I'll make sure and do that.
Yeah, awesome, sweet. Well, I don't ever expect anybody to know everything, so there's no worries there. In fact, One of my favorite movies is the movie called Contact, and somebody asks a question and somebody else says, I don't know. And he says, that's a really good answer. So,
I love Contact.
Isn't that a great movie? So I could talk for a whole session about Contact too. In fact, I'm going through it again for about the 15th time right now. So we are close to the end. If you could change one thing about what's going on in our system, economic, political, whatever, one area of focus, what would that be?
Locally or just kind of?
Yeah, let's make it locally.
Like I mentioned earlier, when I moved here, there's so much energy from the activist community, whether it's environment or police reform, housing. There's a lot of good energy here. And I think a lot of that work has been reflected. Like I'm sure you and your listeners know, 2019, Tacoma and Puyallup both passed climate emergencies. So I think now we have to take that energy and a lot of the a lot of that energy has shown us how to have direct action to influence politicians and other public officials. I would like to see a regional kind of climate plan. You know, a lot of these things are being developed in isolation from each other. I think the way you get something that sticks and that works is more effective is if it's coordinated between all of the different parts of our region. I think and that plan would also have to address those ideas, like we mentioned, like economic insecurity, social justice. But that's what I would see. I'd want to see a coordinated regional plan that prioritizes economic insecurity and social justice, and not have those things siloed. Because I think the only way you can actually have a plan that works is if all those things are included in it.
Yeah, so well, that's a great vision, and it is. I get a little warm glow hearing you say that there's lots of good activism here in Tacoma, because having been here, it's hard, for me to see that. And you coming from the outside to say, oh, there's some engaged, hardworking people here. So that's good to know. And I'm going to make that point every once in a while. So anything else we want to talk about before we sign off here, Evlando?
I mean, if you want to talk about contact, I'm happy to it. But
yeah, go ahead, for sure.
Great conversation. No, I think it was a really great conversation, and you had some really insightful questions. So I appreciate your time.
Yeah, well, I absolutely appreciate your time too, and I'll talk more about this in the outro, but we'll definitely put some links to some of the work you've done, and I'm grateful that there are people like you and there are organizations like Media Matters that information is so critical at this time in our history, and there's so much information floating around out there that's actually false and destructive. So thanks for the work you do. Thanks for the work that Media Matters are doing. And thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. It was great talking to Evlando and getting some awareness of his perspective on climate change and climate justice, especially right here in good old Tacoma. You can check out show notes. I'll give you a link to how to connect with Media Matters for America. It's jam-packed with good stuff that you'll find valuable, so check it out. I did take a look at Sinclair Broadcasting in Washington State, and Como up in Seattle is a Sinclair Broadcasting station. I'd heartily recommend doing a little research on Sinclair and some of their what I can only call propaganda tactics for putting out, among other things, climate disinformation. So check out the show notes at ccltacoma.org. And you can also send me an email at john@ccltacoma.org. Love to hear from you. So thanks for listening, and reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.